Video computers online. Archiving 44K. Initiate sequence.
T minus 30 seconds.
Server connection confirmed.
T minus 25 seconds.
Live stream for T120K.
T minus 20 seconds.
Phone lines are go.
T minus 15 seconds.
Satellite uplink verified.
T minus 10 seconds.
Flight check complete. Satellite uplink verified.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Black Op Radio, the voice of political conspiracy research. You're listening to Black Op Radio, the show NSA doesn't want you to hear. Now here is your host, Leno Sanic.
Everyone, welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. In this segment, we are speaking to Mr. Greg Burnham, the first guest on Black Op Radio. So we started, well, in the year 2000, so that's either 25 or 26 seasons. I'll have to go back to my abacus and figure that one out. But yeah, a quarter century or more of Black Op Radio. Started off with Greg because we're both friends with Fletcher Prouty. And interested in the world around us and the JFK assassination, to be sure, right? So welcome, Greg.
Hi, Len. Good to be here.
Good.
I was just going to say, I'm blown away. The 25, 26 years. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a long time. And one milestone was 2013, the 50th. And what happened then was I did 50 Reasons for 50 Years.
Yes.
So that on top of doing the show, we actually did these things because Gary Mack had made me so mad that, you know, I said, we gotta do more. And I'm going to ask you about what you've been doing. But in the meantime, we have a similar thing happening now where documents are supposed to be released. And finally, there's something happening.
Yeah.
And Oliver Stone, Jim DiEugenio, and Jefferson Morley, a few people were speaking to Congress in that and you know, kind of tell them you should have released these a long time ago, but at least you're doing something now.
Yeah.
So let me ask you, in the last little while, what have you been doing? And let's start off with mentioning your website.
Sure. My website is assassinationofjfk.net. So I kind of wanted to reflect back just a little bit real quickly. So I was on your show, I guess we were still in the middle of the JFK Research Assassination Forum with Rich Della Rosa back in those days. And then I was on The Men Who Killed Kennedy, which was 23 years ago, roughly, this year. And I remember in that show, towards the end of the show, I remember he was asking me some questions and I made a comment that there's no statute of limitations on murder. And if they're still covering it up in 20 more years from now, that's obstruction of justice. It's a conspiracy, right? So interesting, here we are, right? 23 years later from when I said that on The Men Who Killed Kennedy, and they finally supposedly, allegedly, whatever, are releasing all the documents. And I think probably the first comment I want to make about that is there's kind of a fallacy out there that none of the new files, you know, that there's no smoking gun. And the fallacy I find there isn't so much because there is a smoking gun in these new files. Granted, there is some new material. I'm not dismissing that. But of all the documents, I mean, thousands and thousands of documents, there's very few gems, right? Where you go, oh my gosh, this is really something. A lot of it is a bunch of what I call fluff, is I just mean, you know what I mean? It's just routine stuff. And then there's other stuff that's just almost red herring-ish, you know what I mean? Kind of down the rabbit hole, right? So I'm not saying that there's nothing new. But the idea that the media, I mean, now that we have their attention, finally, after all these years, right, they're finally supposedly paying attention, right? But one of the first things they're saying is, well, you know, there was no smoking gun. Well, you know, I want to borrow a phrase from, there was a piece that David Mantic wrote a long time ago, probably going on 20 years ago, 15, 20 years ago, called The Silence of the Historians. And I want to call this The Silence of the Media, because you'd think that we had no smoking guns over the last five decades, to listen to them talk, right? I mean, you know, even when Stone and D'Eugenio were on Fox News recently on Jesse Waters' show, you know, the implication there was they were like, I don't mean they, but I mean the media was still looking for, like, you know, what were they expecting? You know, an FBI document that says we discovered the CIA did it, you know? I'm not sure what they were exactly expecting, right? So I really liked when Oliver Stone said in Congress, you know, that they should reopen the investigation, right? I think that's really important. Not so much so that we can investigate the new documents. And I'm not suggesting that we don't need to investigate those. We do. But the number of documents that have been out for 20, 30, 40 years that are extremely damning, that are themselves smoking guns, they've already been there. They've already been out there. They've been declassified, right? But again, we're relying on the silence of the media for the public to get informed about it. So, you know, I have two problems. One is there are some smoking guns in the new material, but the other fallacy is we've had smoking guns for decades that have been, you know, pretty much ignored. So this call for a reopening of the JFK case, I think, is really important in order to highlight for Congress all this new information that we've been gathering. And I'm not, again, not in this recent document dump, all the work that we've done for 20, 30 years here, digging through, fighting the, you know, the National Archives, fighting declassification, just fighting and fighting and fighting to get the stuff out that we've gotten out that got just completely no news coverage at all. And you'd think that it would get news coverage. So what I would have liked to have seen, and again, I know there's, you know, limited time when you're on television, you're on these shows, they just have a small segment. So this isn't meant critically towards anybody that has done anything. I don't mean it that way at all. But it's too bad that the media hasn't given, and again, I think it will probably take a congressional investigation in order to get this kind of depth, right? But it would be nice if there could be a dedicated program, whether it's on, you know, whatever news outlet, you know, or whatever. That's why I really appreciate Black Op Radio, because it's someplace you can talk about this stuff, where they would get some researchers that are familiar with these documents and these smoking guns to be able to present them. And again, these aren't conspiratorial, you know, researchers. These are fact-based researchers. These are researchers that are reporting on historical events that have been well documented by the government itself. As one example, can you imagine, Lynn, if, so you, I know you're aware of this. It's called CIA document, maybe not by this term, but 1035-960, right? And what is it? It is, quote unquote, concerning criticism of the Warren Report. Now, we're all familiar with that. You and me and most researchers are. I don't know how many people in your audience are. Probably a good number of them are, because most of them, I think, probably keep up with this. But there may be quite a few out there that are not familiar with it, right? So basically, this went out to all the station chiefs, and it was an instruction to them on how to handle criticism of the Warren Report, basically to debunk any and all criticism of the Warren Report, no matter how well-founded it was, that was irrelevant. But it's almost like the UFO thing, right? Anything that has to do with UFOs, shh, it didn't happen, it's not there, just ignore it. Here's how you change it, you debunk it, right? Same kind of a thing here was going on. But this is an actual document. It's a CIA document. We've had this for decades and decades. Now, if we hadn't had this for decades, and let's say this one had just come out with this most recent document dump, I wonder if the media would have seen this as a quote unquote smoking gun, right? Because the whole idea here is the Central Intelligence Agency is attempting to stifle thought on the subject, attempting to stifle debate on the subject, attempting to stifle critical thinking about the subject, right? So to me, that's a huge smoking gun, you know? So I just wonder to myself, you know, if that had been just dumped in this latest document dump, I'm calling it a document dump, but the declassification of these most recent files, if this one would have stood out to anybody in the media where they go, well, my God, that's something. Because guess what? It is something, right? How about this one? I know that you're aware of this one, Len. The Western Cartridge Company document. So for those who are aware or maybe are not aware, whoops, I'm trying to open this thing and I can't get it to work. There it goes. So on December 2nd, 1963, and again, I want to keep this in context, right? This is the context of smoking gun documentation, right? So again, if this document that I'm about, I'm actually going to read this one because it's not very long, right? If this one had been released just now, right, last week or 2 weeks ago, if it had just come out, would the media have jumped on this and said, "My God, this is a big deal," or would they have just been silent like they usually are? Now, this is a FBI memorandum. It's dated the 2nd of December, 1963. So we're talking about, a week, 9 days, something like that, 8 days, 9, 10 days, something like that, after the assassination. And the subject is assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Now, remember, it's an FBI document, and they're referring here to the CIA in the document, and I'll just read it. It says, "My memorandum of 11/23/63, so that was the day after the assassination, set out an additional information relating to the sale and distribution of the Western manufactured 6.5 millimeter Mannlicher-Carcano ammunition used in the assassination. That memorandum was written in response to Mr. Belmont," who is somebody in the FBI, "his instructions," get this, "that every effort be made to trace the ammunition on the possibility that some of it may be traced into Oswald's hands." Now, I'll stop there for a second and I'll go on to the rest of it. But let me stop here for a second and make a comment. In the United States, we've all heard this, the saying that Stalin's top guy in the secret police there, the guy named Beria, right? He was known for his comment that, "You show me the man and I'll find you the crime," right? That's targeted lawfare, right? That's not how we do things in the United States, right? In the United States, you look at the evidence and see where the evidence leads. You find the suspect subsequent to having the evidence, right? You don't start with the suspect first and then try to make the evidence comply to the suspect, right? So this document should have said, "Please trace this ammunition casings. Tell us where they came from." That's where that should have ended. It shouldn't have been to see if you could put it into the suspect's hands. So it's already a biased thing, okay? So leaving that aside, let me keep going. It says the Springfield office has advised that they have obtained through contact at the Western Cartridge Corporation, East Alton, Illinois, copies of that corporation's records relating to the manufacture of this ammunition. Western manufactured 4 million rounds of this ammunition for the United States Marine Corps during 1954. So again, these are the three cartridge casings that were found on the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository that supposedly were the casings from the assassination. Okay, let me go to the next one. "Attached is a two-page copy of the records of Western relating to the complete manufacture of this order of ammunition, which was authorized under government contract DA-23196 ORD-27. And going on, it says, "The interesting thing about this order is that it is for ammunition which does not fit and cannot be fired in any of the United States Marine Corps' weapons. This gives rise to the obvious speculation that it is a contract for ammunition placed by the CIA with Western under a United States Marine Corps cover for concealment purposes. This information is being furnished Divisions 5 and 6 for whatever further investigative activity is deemed warranted." Now, if this would have just been released 2 weeks ago, would the media have thought that was a smoking gun? I mean, after all, the FBI is saying this is, first of all, 8-year-old, nine, sorry, 9-year-old ammunition that was purchased through the Western Cartridge Corporation by the CIA under the Marine Corps cover. Wouldn't that have been a smoking gun? Because it begs the question, how did CIA ammunition end up in the sixth floor of the school book depository building? How did it end up to be happen to be the Mannlicher-Carcano fitting ammunition from the CIA? You see what I mean? So this all kind of these are smoking guns, but we've had these for decades and decades, and yet we had the silence of the media on that one too. And then I'll just say this final one that also stands out. How about this? What if we had not had the LBJ White House tapes all this time and they had just gotten released? Would that have been a smoking gun? Would it have been a smoking gun when Hoover is telling LBJ, when LBJ asks him, were all the shots fired at the president? And Hoover says, yes, they were. And LBJ says, well, how is it that Connally got hit? Now, if you all recall, Connally was sitting in front of JFK. At no time was he ever behind JFK. At no time was he ever between JFK and the sixth floor of the school book depository building. And Hoover says Connally got shot when he turned. And LBJ asks him, so he wouldn't have gotten hit if he wouldn't have turned and been in the way. And Hoover says, oh no, all shots would have hit the president if Connally wouldn't have been in the way. Would they have considered that a smoking gun if it had just been released 2 weeks ago? Because he was the director of the FBI, and this recording was made 1 or 2 days before the FBI issued its final report, because the Warren Commission was formed on November 29th. This was like the, I think this conversation was either the 27th or 28th. I mean, it was within, something like 24, 48, maybe 72 hours of the FBI issuing its report. And at that moment, Hoover's basically telling LBJ, a shot came from the front. How could Connally have blocked a shot to Kennedy unless it came from the front? See, but again, the silence of the media. There was no concern. When these re got released decades ago, the media was aware of it. They knew it. They'd have little clips of it. You'd see these specials on CNN or on these different, networks, and they'd have these little clips, and you'd hear this, the dicta belt thing, and then you'd hear him talking to the secretary, and then they get somebody on there, another. But they just kind of glossed over this. They glossed over this whole thing, this conversation with Hoover, where he's basically saying there's a guy in the front shooting. See? So these are things that are still a concern to me. I don't have a whole lot of high hopes about the new release. Now, to be clear, the reason that we don't have all the information should never be because the government refused to provide the documentation of the event that they have. So having full disclosure is obviously extremely, extremely important. But without having an active media that is interested in the subject, not a media that's asleep at the wheel, not a media that doesn't want to, ruffle feathers, not a media that doesn't want to be blamed, for exposing the deep state, not a media that doesn't want to be accused of being, conspiracists or whatever, right? An honest media, a media who wants to look at the facts and get it out there for everybody to see and scrutinize it and ask the tough questions and not just keep brushing it under the rug, So that's for me what my thoughts have been recently with this, with the new releases. I think that even if there was a huge smoking gun in it, I'm not sure that the media, I'm not sure how much they would even pay attention to it or understand the significance of it, because their pattern so far has been abominable. I mean, just really, really, abominable.
Well, like you just said, understand what I mean. When they have a negative interest in it, they don't even want to understand it.
Yes.
So if they were to release files on the working history of George Joannides, I mean, it would be like hieroglyphics to them. But they would,
Right.
who was he? Well, why is that important? Whatever, and then you have
Yes.
to explain everything to them, where
Yes.
at least to our community of people tuning in here and other places, they will recognize the importance of some of these things. And that's what I'm hoping a few things get out, that
Yeah.
as people let them go, well, that can't be that important. But when we stand back and look at the big picture, I was just saying to Jim DiEugenio that what this every one of these little releases does not point to Lee Oswald and the lone
No.
assassin. So that's the good thing about it. It doesn't, there's nothing in here that is proving their case.
Right.
Everything is just another little chip, chipping away at. Well, I think a few newscasts have been starting to lean toward, because they're failing. They know that between, independent media like the Joe Rogans or stuff, or you hear Black Op Radio thing, the people just don't believe it. They don't believe the Warren Commission. So they got all ears up to say, okay, explain to me how the Warren Commission failed.
Yeah.
And that's what I think, when people read the documents, they get that. They go, yeah, they really didn't solve anything.
Well, and the other thing that's interesting, and again, this reflects on the same problem with media. In 1978, right, the House Select Committee on Assassinations, they were highly critical of the Warren Report, and yet the media was silent, right? The media kept pushing The Warren Commission's report of it. It was a lone nut. It was a lone nut. It was a lone nut. Lone nut. Even though the House Select Committee on Assassinations had more evidence, they had more time to look at it. They reviewed everything the Warren Commission had done, and they thought it was a completely incompetent and sloppy job, and came to themselves to a different conclusion. And yet the media was mostly silent on, on the subject, And how about this? Like books like Inside the Arb, as an example, by Doug Horne, right? The whole book's it's a book of smoking guns. You know what I mean? And I don't, that's been out for a long time,
Well, the biggest one of the revelations to me was that people on the high up on the committee, they all thought it was a lone gunman Lee did it, So as they send out lower level staffers to do something, oh, forget about that. We don't need that, whatever. I mean, they were almost to a man, except for one or two guys at the top there, ready to just consider that the Warren Commission had it right.
When and the Warren Commission was a split decision, not, what I mean? It was two or three of them that never bought the magic bullet theory. Boggs and Dick Russell come to mind.
Yeah, and the thing about that is that it was a different time where people actually did trust the government. There was Eisenhower, your general, and the people that were in power. They were doing good for our country. Salute the flag, and even I think I heard from you or other people that saying like, "Well, my president, right or wrong, I'm standing behind my president." But after Watergate and after some in Vietnam and so many things, the chip away, she's like, I don't know if I believe these guys anymore. And that's, I think that distrust has been earned.
Well, and the another area where the media could do itself a lot of good is to approach it more scientifically than sensationally, David Mantic work, all of his work, by the way, comes to mind here. He's written phenomenal books on the scientific, the forensics of this, the medical evidence, and a lot. There are several different things that he did at the National Archives that are just waiting for people to come and replicate. These are scientific experiments on the autopsy materials, right? That the public, not the public, but I guess the public, right? I mean, they even have an optical densitometer there at the National Archives that you can use to measure what David Mantic writes about in his book. Michael Chesser, Dr. Michael Chesser, has been the only person, to my knowledge, that has even gone there and bothered to try to replicate it. And he did, in fact, replicate the exact same outcome, results that Mantic had outlined in his book. And in Dr. Mantic's book, he outlines for anybody who wants to go to the National Archives the procedure that you need to use in order to replicate these experiments and prove to yourself what is and what isn't on this, So I think, the more we can get some science into it, I think that's really important. And there's, again, like I say, now there's tons of science in this, And again, the silence is deafening, and the disinterest is deafening. It's almost like anything that keeps the story alive as a maybe or a whodunit or we're not sure yet, they'll stick with that. But anything that tends to make it case open as opposed to case closed, case still open, they avoid that.
Yeah,
They
well,
avoid
some
that.
network they trotted out Gerald Posner, two weeks ago. It's like what? I mean, who in their right mind would ask him anything?
Who have you plagiarized lately?
Yeah, but that's small potatoes to the, now at least with the USAID revelations about how they just have seen money for anything, and they'll fund this. And then it goes down two or three things where you can't trace where the money came from. Now they're funding this. I'm sure they were funding like McAdams type people, and just making sure that the guy always had a grant to had time to do stuff, because they knew what he was going to do, even though the name on that grant didn't say that. But they were just flooding out money for disinformation, and just the poverty of that whole outlook of a government that's saying, We're just not going to tell the. I mean, that's why it's held back these many years.
Yeah.
Imagine that. They don't want to tell people what happened, and
Yeah.
it's not because it was a lone gunman and a Marxist. And it's really pretty dark. And
Yeah.
that's why just concerned citizens like such as yourself. When I first met you in person, I think it was at the Encinitas.
Yeah, Encinitas, yeah.
Right, conference. So people would put on something, have speakers on, and you were the MC, I think, of it,
The
right?
moderator, yeah.
Okay, sure. And the FBI or State Department or Department of Justice, they didn't do that. It took
No.
concerned citizens to say, listen, there's a lot you need to know about this, and here we're going to put on something on a Saturday night or something. And Mark
Yeah.
Lane was famous for putting on lectures on that, I think, in New York and other places. But yeah, it's taken just concerned citizens to force the government to, years later, try to come up with something. And
Yeah.
like I said earlier, every little thing they come up with does not cement in that it was a lone assassin and Lee Oswald did it, and he was even on the sixth floor. It's like they're bending anything they can, and I see people like a McAdams type people or a Posner that are it's just an insult to intelligence, really. It's one thing
Yeah.
to say, I'm going to have a debate with you, like, look at this picture. Is that Lee Oswald in the doorway or not? And you go, hey, it looks like him. Well, how can we prove it? Nah, it's a little grainy. They say it was Billie Lovelady. Well, it's, so you could have that debate or discussion with researchers. But
Right.
yeah, several of the things are just so far beyond that. And I can't believe that people are still having debates and that with some of these people. I mean, you had a good one a long time ago with the Mr. Paul Nolan, right?
Yeah, right. John
Right.
McAdams,
Yeah,
yeah.
and
Yeah.
it's almost pointless. It's like arguing a flat earth type thing,
Yeah, it's really an odd situation. I don't consider academia much better on this subject either, I've been to classes before just as a guest, to observe and just to see, because I've heard of, different colleges, universities that have a course on this, or they're going to spend a day or two on it or whatever, and I've sat in, and the level of ignorance, I guess, is too light a word, but is profound. It's just unbelievable what what I mean. The conclusions that they come to based on so little knowledge, and they're teaching this to students, but here's some interesting things too. I've noticed that the younger generation, when I say that, I'm talking about people in their 20s. I found quite a few of them that are more interested in the subject than their 40-year counterparts. And I was actually quite surprised. One example was at my dentist office, right? My of all places, my dental hygienist. We were just, talking, and you can only talk so much when you get your teeth done. So then she had to stop talking because the subject somehow came up. I'm not sure how. And when I mentioned that, I had, been researching this other, she was like all excited, and just she was like a sponge. She wanted to know more and more and more. And then the next time I went back, she had gone to my website. She had read all kinds of stuff on my website. She had all these questions. I mean, she was engaged, super engaged in the subject. And there's a here in the building that we live in, there's a neighbor of ours who has a granddaughter who I think she's probably about 22. She doesn't live here anymore, but she was staying with him for a while. And we met, my wife and she became friends, but we were talking. When my wife mentioned something about the subject, she again, same reaction, totally engaged. Just, I'm seeing that a lot more now in people who are more than, that are like in their 20s and 30s and early 20s even, and that's only two examples. I probably have a dozen examples of where there's this real interest. And this is before the document dump, this is before this most recent stuff. They were already engaged. And I'm not sure how that came about. I'm not sure why it came about, but I'm glad it did, you know. So who, you know, we need people to carry the torch, you know, once we're not here anymore to do this, because you know, I remember Jack White, and I used to talk about that a lot, you know, because Jack was probably 25 years my senior, something like that, you know. And Noel Twyman and I used to talk about that a lot as well, you know, and both of them have passed away, you know, but we don't want to have this end when we end, because it's, you know, just for the sake of the world, you know, and for
Yeah,
the
well, one sad anecdote about that is when I was coming up to my 1,000th show, I started going through the guest list and I'd seen that there's over 50 people had passed away. You know,
Wow.
like you mentioned Jack White and then, you know, Fletcher Prouty and, you know,
Noel Twyman,
yeah, right. I was thinking of John Judge and
Mark
just,
Lane,
right, yeah. So many, right?
yeah.
People that really did go good work in it. And cared. So that's good that you are carrying the torch with your website as well, and you're meeting people who actually do care, saying, you know, this could be old history, or just thinking of the Bill Hicks anecdote. He said, well, you know, don't care about the Kennedy assassination. That was so long ago. Why do you care about that? So he says, okay, well then stop talking about Jesus.
Yeah.
So, you know, like, no, sir, you know, people think that the world took a real wrong turn at the Kennedy assassination,
Yeah.
and some other form of government moved in, and it's been nonstop war after war after war. To what benefit? And yeah, when you study some of the people like the Hillary Clinton and you know these guys, and they just they're it's always the next one. What's the next one? What's the next one? It's you know.
Yeah.
And I looked up to, you know, John Kennedy of his idea of, you know, we breathe the same air, drink the same water, and believe in our
Yep.
children's future. We have to start getting along.
Yep.
So,
Yep. It's
yeah.
really important. Yeah. You know, I don't know if this is a smoking gun or not, but I wish I could find the answer to it. I think Hemming's the first person, Jerry Hemming, pointed this out to me. That you know, the CIA has cryptonyms, right? So the cryptonym for Lee Harvey Oswald, as we probably have all seen on all these classified documents over the decades we've been studying this, his was GP slash floor, FLOOR, GP like government program slash floor, right? Robert F. Kennedy's is GP focus, and JFK's was GP ideal. And those are the only three people in the history of the CIA that had the cryptonym that started GP. Now, I don't know what it means. It might not mean anything, but it's just kind of curious, you know? Kind of curious.
Yeah.
So maybe that'll come out someday as a hidden smoking gun. I don't know.
All right. Well, kind of running out of time for today right now.
Yeah.
Before we wrap up, is there anything else you want to get to right now, or just.
Well, no. How about this, Lynn? How about you saying something about the 25 plus years here now that we've, you know, that you've been doing this? You know, I can still remember the first show. You know, I don't remember it vividly, like, you know what I mean, like everything we talked about by any means,
Yeah,
but I.
well, it was the show number one, and then there was maybe 5 or 10 people that I thought I'd talk to, and then of course I never dreamed it'd go on this year, and just never even dreamed. Remember talking to Anita saying, "Okay, let's get 10 people that we always want to talk to, and then
Yep.
we'll just play it by ear." And then you've been on over the years, you know, so many other ones in the archives. So,
Yeah. Yeah.
but no, well, I guess keep in touch with me and email, and let's just have you on it again, and we'll see where some of these documents lead, and then maybe dig into some of the things that are on your website, assassinationofjfk.net, right?
Yes. Yeah, that sounds great. Love to do it.
Okay, then. Well, then it's been a pleasure speaking to you, guest number one, for all this time, and we'll be in touch more often.
Sounds good, Len Hank. Congratulations on 25 plus years of success, and you definitely passed Mae Brussel now.
Oh, yeah.
That
That
quite a
was
while ago.
I was looking to that. I think it was 887 shows or something.
Something
Anyway.
like that. Yeah, I remember you always saying, I don't know if we'll get there, but well, you did. You left her in the dust, but she's never going to be forgotten.
Oh yeah. That's
That's for sure.
somebody we stood on the shoulders of giants, you know.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yep.
All
All
right.
right.
All right, thanks again, Greg.
Okay, Len, you take care, buddy.
Hello everyone. Welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. In this segment we're speaking to Mr. Jim DiEugenio. Hello, Jim.
Good evening, Len.
Well, we haven't spoken for 2 weeks or so, and a lot has gone on. I turn on the channel, and there you are with Oliver Stone testifying, and then many different TV shows had people on, and they're saying, "What's this with the JFK records?" And thank you for taking time tonight. We're going to go over that maybe if the public perception is ready to dig in more, and what your impression was of all these interviews. That I was pleasantly surprised to see anybody talking about this stuff on the news.
Well, I believe that that hearing had an impact. Did you watch the whole thing?
Yes, I did.
I thought it was pretty interesting. And I wrote as on my Substack, you'll see a column I wrote, which is it's the most well-read column that I've written so far, and it's only been up for like a few days. All right, it's called Jim and Oliver Meet the Luna Committee. And I describe my whole experience with this thing. See, initially Oliver wasn't even going to go. He was, Jim, it's a 5-hour air flight. Okay. And do you really think it's worth it? I mean, because he's had some bad experience with this stuff. But then, so I said, okay, then just make a list of recommendations that you want her to fulfill. And that's all I thought he was going to do. And then his secretary, right, his executive assistant, Cassandra, calls me up and says, Jim, we got some news for you. I go, oh, okay, what? And he goes, I'll let Oliver tell you. So Oliver changed his mind and he decided to go and he invited me to go with him. And the first night, well, first afternoon, first of all, I had to wake up at 4:30 because we had a very early flight out of LAX. And we got into Washington, D.C. And first of all, I was very disappointed in the hotel that Jeff Morley recommended for us. It's called the Tabard Inn. If anybody's going there, don't go to that hotel, okay? So we had this meeting at 5 o'clock in Luna's office. And like I wrote in my Substack column, I thought there were going to be like five people there. Like me, Oliver, Jeff, the person running the committee, Jake, and Luna. We walk in and her office is full. There was standing room only, including three members of the committee, all right? And so we had like about a 90-minute talk getting ready for the next day. And so Oliver said that he wanted me to wake up early and meet him down in the lounge because he wanted me to consult on his speech. Well, I made a terrible mistake. I left my bag at the airport with my sleeping pills in it. And so I'm laying on the bed there and I get this email from Oliver saying, Jim, forget it. I'm writing this speech right now. And so we go to the meeting, the hearing, and the minute we walk in, all the paparazzi cameras go off for Oliver. And then we take our seats, and there's a guy next to me who I never heard of. So I walk over to Jeff and I say, who's this guy? And he goes, the Democrats invited him to come because he wants to complain about the Social Security numbers being declassified in the new documents. Now, when I heard that, this was the prelude to my surprise about this committee, because it was the Republicans who really were interested in the case, not the Democrats. In fact, I don't think any Democrat stayed for even half the hearing, or as more than one Republican did. Okay, I think about five or six of them did. And they by far asked the better and more interested questions. How to explain this? I tried to explain it in my Substack column by saying, I think part of this is the war that Trump is having with the FBI. And I mentioned the FBI performance a couple of times in my speech. So any intelligent person cannot examine this case and not mention the FBI. All right. So I think this is kind of malingering effect of on the Democrats on this this whole issue. All right. And so Jeff made his speech, Oliver made his speech, and then I went third. And then this other guy, I think his name is Davison, he went last. And in my speech, I talked about mostly the corrosive effects of the Kennedy assassination on the social fabric of America. Like, for instance, 65% of the public does not believe the Warren Commission verdict. 91% of the public believes that something went seriously wrong with the country after Kennedy was killed. And I said 75% of the public believed in what the government was saying in 1960. By the 90s, it was down to 19%. The biggest single year drop was the year the Warren Commission report was issued. So those are kind of the themes that I hit on. And I said at the end, words of the effect, the FBI and the CIA should not have the last word on JFK's assassination. You shouldn't. And so, you know, the questions from the Republican side, I thought were pretty good. The only guy who was asking pointed questions from the Democratic side was Mr. Garcia. And Mr. Garcia was challenging Jeff Morley. Do you have any direct evidence that links the CIA to the Kennedy assassination? I really wish I would have interjected at that point, because I would have said two things. Mr. Garcia, during the Church Committee hearings, Senators Schweiker and Hart conducted a mini investigation of the Kennedy assassination. James Angleton was called to testify. A reporter asked him afterwards about the JFK case. Angleton made one of the most mysterious and disturbing comments ever in the JFK case. He said, "A mansion has many rooms. I was not privy to who struck John." Now, if that isn't direct enough for you, how about this? When Mark Lane was involved in a case involving Victor Marchetti in Spotlight magazine, he heard about a memo prepared out of Angleton's office that said words of the effect that they had to make an excuse for Howard Hunt being in Dallas on the day of the JFK assassination. Nobody wanted to believe that such a document existed. But Lane tracked down Joe Trento, a reporter who was a friend of Angleton's. He said he saw the memo. It later turned out that Angleton had showed it to him, all right? And then when Lane asked him, "Well, what do you think he was trying to say?" And Trento said, "Well, knowing Jim Angleton, he was telling Dick Helms, whose office it went to, don't think that I'm going to take the rap for this by myself. If I go, you're going with me." Because Hunt was out of Helms' office, not Angleton's. Now, I don't know, Mr. Garcia, how more direct you can get than that, okay? But most lawyers would say that that constitutes what they call consciousness of guilt. That's what I wish I would have said. That's what I wish Jeff would have said. But we did manage to get in a lot of good points. If you watched a hearing, Oliver brought up the three secretaries on the fourth floor. Jeff brought up the lies of the CIA about the Kennedy case, Helms, Angleton, and Joannides. All right. And then I talked about CE-399 and the 42 witnesses who saw an avulsive wound in the back of Kennedy's skull. All right.
I think what I got from it, that there was a quiet confidence from the people speaking, saying, "Look, you and Oliver, Destiny Betrayed, said, we know an awful lot more. We know way more. And you guys have got to start taking this seriously." And that's kind of what I got from it.
Yeah, I think that was one of the subtle messages that we tried to get across, or that we really understood the case. And I really think, Len, that I'm not positive about this, but I think that's the first time that that kind of information was ever conveyed at a congressional hearing in public. You know, it might have been in private sessions or in closed sessions, but I don't think it's ever been conveyed to a congressional committee in public. Plus, it was broadcast by C-SPAN, live, all right?
Oh, I was watching over the internet, right?
Oh, you had a live?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, you had a, what do they call that?
Live streaming.
Yeah, live streaming.
But rather than a TV station and being in Canada finding C-SPAN, it was like live on the web.
Okay, good for you.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure, but have you seen, well, you probably have because you saw me on television. Me, Jeff, and Matt Crumpton did at least 5 shows afterwards, maybe 6. We did 2 on Fox, 2 on News Nation. Matt did Newsmax, and I think Jeff did another one from Washington, Capital Week in Review or something. So if you then add up, have you seen all the postings of that on the internet? On YouTube?
I've seen a few.
Well, there's more than a few. There must be 30.
Yeah.
There must be 30 postings of either the whole hour and 50-minute thing or parts of it on the web just from Forbes magazine. That's just one platform, 1.6 million views. 1.6 million views. Now, if you add that in to the ratings, for example, for the Waters show, and Newsmax and News Nation, et cetera. I mean, you're talking like, I would say minimum 11 million. All right. So we haven't had an impact like this in a very, very long time. So thanks to Oliver for changing his mind and deciding to attend that hearing.
Yeah. And another thing that troubled me was just before that, they started bringing out Gerald Posner and the whole, you know, Flat Earth Society. I mean, to see him speaking about anything, it's like, are you kidding me? I thought out of shame he just left, you know, but whatever. How pathetic.
It also got good coverage. There's an ABC News report. There's a CBS News report. USA Today. All right. The most negative by far that I saw was on The Hill, you know, that political website. Their chief witness was Fred Litwin. I go, oh, my God, Jesus criminy. All right. Why don't you just wake up John McAdams from his grave? Yeah. So they went after it. Okay. And they said that words of the effect that Luna had loaded up the dais. Okay. Well, Len, I think after 62 years, I think that's long enough to wait for our side to load up the dais because we've been looking at the other side. You know, with people like Bugliosi, with people like Posner, with people like Latimer, with those kind of people for 62 years, Dale Myers, Gus Russo. So I think it's fine that we actually got the main speaking engagement. I think 6 decades is long enough to wait.
Yeah, yeah. And just the whole poverty of bringing up somebody like Fred Litwin, I mean, that's got to be a USAID in action, right?
You know. Oh, my God. So I think, in my opinion, I thought that it was a win for our side. I thought it went pretty well. Thank God for the Republicans, you know, because I don't think we would have got any really – oh, and they were very curious about Gary Underhill, the Gary Underhill case. So that was all – I thought very interesting, a study in dichotomy. And I wrote in my Substack column, I go, don't these people understand that Kennedy was a liberal Democrat? And since they were all from minority groups on the Democratic side, don't they understand that he wrote the first affirmative action executive order back in 1961? I mean, come on, let's have a little bit of respect for what the guy was and what he was trying to accomplish. You know, against very difficult odds. But that was my first congressional hearing. So I didn't. Oh, the Nancy Mace was allowed to take the chair for a few minutes. And she complained about the Hunter Biden laptop. You know, why aren't we? And I wanted to say this, but I didn't. Miss Mace, I agree with you. The Hunter Biden laptop was a very bad thing. It was very poorly handled, etc. But I don't see how the Hunter Biden laptop resulted in the death of 58,000 American soldiers, making 375,000 of them paraplegics, resulting in the death of 3 million Vietnamese, and indirectly 2 million Cambodians through the rise of Pol Pot after the fall of Sihanouk. So let's have a little bit of weighing of the value and the importance of these events in history. Yeah, again, that's another thing I should have said, but I didn't.
Well, you know, all in all, it's very encouraging. And
it's not over. It's not over. Jeff Morley did an interview with ABC Radio. I think it was either today or yesterday. And you'll send me the link when it gets broadcast. And I might have even bigger news than that. I don't want to talk about it right now. But the impact of that hearing was really something. I mean, this is the case that won't go away. And this Luna, Anna Luna, is a real firebrand on it. She's convinced that the Warren Commission report was wrong. I mean, Len, when have we last had a congressional committee led by someone who thinks that way? You know, I can't remember one that was so outspoken on, and she's essentially a beginner on the case. You know, she's only been at it for 2 or 3 months, you know, so once she gets up to speed, she should really be a help to us. Now, everybody knows the occasion for this was Donald Trump's executive order, which declassified all the classified documents, not on just the JFK case, but the King case and the RFK case. Now, I've gone through some of this, and for people to call it a nothing burger is ridiculous. I spent some time at the hearing talking about the Schlesinger memo. I'm sure you know what that is, right? For the first time since 1961, the Schlesinger memo was finally released unredacted. If you haven't read it, I strongly recommend that you read it. I think everybody understands what it was. This was JFK and Arthur Schlesinger trying to reorganize the CIA after the disaster of the Bay of Pigs. Kennedy felt, well, he didn't feel, he knew that he had been lied to and deceived and tricked into going along with that ill-fated operation. And when he found out from his brother that this was Dulles' secret agenda, that they were going to snooker him with an attack they knew would fail, counting on him to go ahead and send in the Marines, this is what really drove him up the wall. And so the Schlesinger memo was their plan to reorganize the CIA. One of the things that Schlesinger discovered was that the CIA had infiltrated the State Department. Now, I'm sure Fletcher Prouty knew about this, okay, although I can't recall off my head when he wrote about it, but I'm sure he understood this, all right, because he wrote about this kind of stuff all the time. But he actually had statistics. He said 47% of State Department employees overseas are really CIA agents. And he said there's 128 of them in just the American Embassy in Paris. And on the night that the OAS tried to overthrow de Gaulle, the lights were on that floor all night long. So this, of course, reflects upon JFK's panicky call with the French ambassador in Washington during the attempted overthrow of de Gaulle. And he says, words of the effect, I can't tell you if we're involved in this. We might be involved covertly, and I don't know about it. Because half the time, I don't know what these guys are doing. All right? Now, if you want me to sail the 7th Fleet into the Mediterranean to show our backup of Charles de Gaulle, I'll be glad to do it. But I can't tell you if we're involved in this, one way or the other. All right, and so this is one of the things that provoked him and Schlesinger to go ahead and try for this reorganization plan. And if you haven't read the memo, I strongly recommend you do. It's a pretty radical reorganization. Schlesinger didn't even want to call it the CIA anymore. He wanted to take that title away. And he wanted to make them more of an intelligence gathering you know, less money on covert action, more money on intelligence and information gathering. Okay. And he wanted to cut down on this whole CIA infiltration of the State Department, you know, because he thought that when the CIA came in, they would bring in these thuggish kind of characters along with them, which he was exposed to during the Bay of Pigs operation. All right. So that's just one thing that I think is incredibly important, is the Schlesinger memo. Now, a couple of the other things that I got. How about this? In a 1971 memo, the CIA admits they have no credible evidence that Kostikov is Department 13. That's really important because on the day of the assassination, out of Angleton's office came this announcement that A. Oswald was associated with Kostikov and Kostikov was part of Department 13, which is involved in Western Hemisphere assassinations.
And for those who don't know, out of Mexico City.
Right. Kostikov was one of the Russian diplomats, but he was really a KGB agent at the Mexico City consulate, the Soviet Union consulate. All right. 8 years later, the CIA admits we don't have any credible evidence. So was Angleton trying to frame Oswald on the day of the assassination with this accusation that Kostikov was part of Department 13 and therefore Oswald killed Kennedy for Kostikov? You know, that's a very interesting, very, very interesting comment, I believe. Then there's the Epstein memo. The CIA sent out a memo, I believe, in early 1968, referencing the Epstein article on Jim Garrison in the New Yorker. On the declassified document, it actually finally says how many stations that memo went out to. I could hardly believe it. It went out to 80 stations. 80 stations. That's how important the CIA thought it was to discredit Jim Garrison with this Edward Epstein article in the New Yorker. Incredible. All right, another important thing. As late as 1969, Fidel Castro was very much disturbed by the Kennedy assassination. He doesn't think that Oswald could have done what the Warren Commission said he did. So he commissioned a reenactment. All right, after speaking to some students for 2 hours, he commissioned a reenactment, and he said he wanted his three best marksmen to try and do what Oswald did. Guess what, Len? They couldn't do it. So what this means is that every attempt at duplicating Oswald's feat of marksmanship has failed. There's this one. There's Carlos Hathcock, the greatest sniper of the Vietnam era, who was running a SWAT team training center. He tried to do it, and CBS failed. And then when they understood that they couldn't do it, they cheated. All right, that's in my article, how CBS News aided the JFK cover-up. All right. So if the best marksman in the world couldn't do it, I mean, the question is, how the heck could Oswald do it? Because he wasn't that good. All right. Now, here's another one. In a I think it's 1977 memo, the CIA itself talks about all their coverage in Mexico City. All right. You know, their camera coverage of both the Cuban consulate and the Russian consulate. This is how they refer to the guy going into the Russian consulate. Quote, alleged to be Oswald, unquote. Then later in the memo, they say Oswald allegedly visited the Soviet embassy. Allegedly? This is the CIA itself saying that Oswald allegedly visited the Mexico City station? The USSR? Please. All right. No wonder they didn't want to declassify this stuff. On November 23rd, 1963, a tank detail moved into the Havana area. Now, I don't know if this was directly because of the Castro speech the night before, but if you recall, Castro went on national television saying that already he had doubts about the story about Kennedy's assassination. And he mentioned in this speech that you watch and see, they're going to blame us for this, which of course they ended up doing. All right. So I just wonder if those tanks moving into Havana, the outskirts of Havana, were because of that speech that Castro gave. You know, I can't be certain about it. Okay, but I suspect that that's the reason. All right, now the last thing that I think is interesting. There's notes by Robert Blakey to the CIA requesting the reasons that a 201 file would be opened up. Then his second question is, he wanted to see the Oswald file prior to the 201 opening. Now, why is that interesting? Because of Betsy Wolf. Betsy Wolf was the analyst of the Oswald file for the House Select Committee on Assassinations. She, and I talked about this before, she was the first person to discover that there was something really weird going on about Oswald's file at the CIA. First of all, it did not go where it was supposed to go. It should have gone to the Soviet Russia division. It went to the Office of Security. Secondly, there was no 201 file open for 13 months. 13 months. Here you have a guy, a former Marine, who gets a hardship discharge, crosses the Atlantic, goes to the Helsinki station, which is the only one that gives you a visa in 48 hours, crosses into Moscow, and at the American embassy, he threatens to give away intelligence secrets, and you don't open a 201 file on them. That broke all the rules. So this is what Betsy Wolf was very puzzled about. So she called in retired CIA official after retired CIA official, and they all said, you're right. You're right. There should have been a 201 file open, and it should have gone to the SR division. But nobody could explain to her why it happened that way. Even Dick Helms was surprised when he learned this, that there was no 201 file opened on Oswald. So finally, in November of 1978, just when the committee is about to go out of business, she calls in a guy named Bob Gambino. Bob Gambino was the chief of security at that time. He answered the question. He said, look, it doesn't matter how many documents come in. It doesn't matter if they're pre-stamped. If the client has gone to the first gate, which is the Office of Mail Logistics, that is the office that will get the documents, not anyone else. So this is why Blakey was writing letters to the CIA, all right, What are the reasons that you open up a CIA, a 201 file on somebody? And I want to see Oswald's file before the 201 file was open. So in other, now here's the capper. Even though Blakey was aware of this problem, and these letters of the CIA reveal that, Betsy Wolf's work is not in the House Select Committee volumes. In my opinion, it was some of the most important things ever known about Oswald. And it would have given us a jump start if it would have been in there. We had to wait for John Newman and his book, Oswald and the CIA, to find out about this, which I think is 1995. So these are some of the interesting things that the mass media is calling nothing burgers. They're anything but nothing burgers. And let me add a couple more points. I'm sure everybody knows who David Slauson was. David Slauson was a member of the Warren Commission, part of their junior counsel. He has always tried to say, I think he passed away recently, but he's always tried to say there was nothing to this case. Well, it turns out that David Slauson was very interested in how Oswald got into the Soviet Union as quickly as he did. And also about his maneuvers in Helsinki, because that's the city that he chose to get in, all right? Because I'm sure everybody here who listens to me knows that when Oswald got into Helsinki, he stayed at the Hotel Torni, which is a very high-class hotel, all right? Then he checked out after a day and went to the Klaus Kirki, which is another very high-class hotel. Like the Hotel Torni is a 4-star hotel. The Klaus Kirki is a 3.5-star hotel. Oswald should have been staying at Motel 6, but he wasn't, all right? And these were in rather close proximity to the Soviet embassy, okay? And Slauson was asking how long would it take Oswald to get to the Soviet embassy from where he was? It's these kinds of questions, you know, because this all indicates that somebody had told Oswald about getting into the Soviet Union through the Helsinki Russian embassy. So these are the things that are turning up in these so-called nothing burger files, which I believe are kind of important and should have been released a long time ago, all right? But as I said in my speech, secrecy is the enemy of democracy, all right? It's sort of like the rattlesnake, you know, that waits outside for somebody to come out the door. You cannot have an open democracy if you have this kind of secrecy about one of the most important events in the whole second half of the 20th century. So,
yeah, you know what happens. If this blows up, then they're going to say next, well, what about Bobby Kennedy? What about Martin Luther King? And what about 9/11? What about just all these other things?
Well, those are some of the other things that she's studying. She's going to study the Bobby Kennedy case, the Martin Luther King case, the Jeff Epstein case, the origins of CV-19, the 9/11 files, and UFOs. So she's going to be, but she decided, I believe, very intelligently to lead off the first open hearing with the JFK case. And that's why she wanted Oliver to get there, because she knew that he would create a lot of publicity, you know, for this thing, which he did. All right. So that was from a PR point of view. I thought that that was a very deft stroke, you know, on her part. She played it very smartly. Now, Lisa Pease, of course, is probably the best researcher on the RFK case. And she's going to be, I think, writing either something for us, or if not, it's going to be into a mainstream kind of publication. She discovered some very interesting new evidence, all right, that she's going to be writing about on that. She said on the King case, the problem is that the African-American congressmen don't want to touch on it because they think there'll be too much smear stuff in those files. You know, evidently David Garrow scared the heck out of all those African-American congressmen who admired Martin Luther King with his last article about King's supposed infidelities, which Jeff Carter replied to for us, you know. But that's really a shame. It really is. But we'll see how that plays out. I did recommend that for the Robert Kennedy case, they interview Lisa Pease, and that they, for the King case, they interview John Avery Emison. And by the way, I have to tell you, John did a revised and expanded version of his Martin Luther King book. And it's very good. You should have him on. You had him on once before. I think you should have him on again. All right. So that brings us up to date on the status of the Luna Committee hearings. And if you want to read more about it, take a look at my Substack article. And I also have an article at kennedysandking.com called The Impact of the Luna Hearings. And we also have a link to what I thought was the best interview that me and Oliver did in the wake of that hearing. All right, so kennedysandking.com. Go over there and take a look. My Substack article. And let me now get to some questions. All right, because I haven't been on in a while. So let me do the best I can with these.
Yeah, while you were away, we had Jimmy Dore on.
Yeah, I heard about that.
And well, you should listen to it. It's a good one. And John Armstrong again. And John Armstrong continues to find new things that are so interesting. And like I have to, you know, preface, look, at you may not exactly agree with his conclusion of the two Oswalds from the grade school or the caretaker or this and that, you know. But if you just listen to what he digs up, it's infinitely interesting. I mean, he goes through these records and he finds just more and more information.
Yes, I agree. I agree. John's, if you haven't read John's book, it's an very interesting book. All right. And even outside the whole thing about the two Oswalds, he has a very good chapter on Mexico City in there. And he wrote the first really detailed analysis explaining that the Warren Commission stuck Oswald with the wrong rifle. All right. All right. Mitch Gander, March 20th, 2025. When the assassination happened, there was a strong belief that the murder had been planned and executed by a crazed faction of the right wing, renegade former members of American intelligence, disgruntled Cuban exiles, and the mafia who participated in the failed invasion of Cuba, the Bay of Pigs. Alan Dulles, George Herbert Walker Bush, all right, Charles Cabell, Frank Sturgis, E. Howard Hunt. Lee Oswald was a low-level government agent trying to do the patriotic thing by infiltrating the John Birch Society in Dallas, where General Edwin Walker gave regular fascistic speeches to the Dallas police and Jack Ruby before the killing. Well, there's not a question in there, so I won't answer any questions. I think that Oswald was an undercover agent. I do think that he was spying on what I believe to be the Cuban exiles in Dallas at the house on Harlandale Avenue. That was supposed to be an Alpha 66 branch. All right. And I believe that he more or less has the, I believe it was the CIA, the Cuban exiles, and then later when Oswald escaped the Texas theater, where I think he was supposed to be shot, I believe they brought in their organized crime buddies from their plots to kill Castro. And that's essentially how the plot went down. Okay, March the 20th. Here we go. Tim, I think Angleton was reaching for a Russian connection, but found a U.S. one. I sensed he wasn't in on whatever led to JFK being shot, more worried that it was something that he missed. Hence his reference to Washington conflicts in resolving Washington problems. It was Angleton who suspected the USSR poisoned Hugh Gaitskell of the UK Labour Party. Gaitskell died in January 1963 of a rare tropical infection after he visited Russia. Angleton suspected it was a fix to make Harold Wilson the prime minister, who he suspected was a Russian asset. By 1963, with the swinging 60s, it was a given that Labour would win. All right. Angleton was obsessed with the USSR, but there's no evidence that JFK was under the orbit of Soviet control. All right. I found the questioning of Angleton meandering, and it was actually Angleton who said things of substance. I imagine he's talking about the church committee there. The Australian connection to the United Kingdom is always interesting. Australia only gained full independence in 1986. Australian passports still said British passport until 1967, as that flowed from the same head of state after. UK nuclear testing in the post-Manhattan Project era was done in Australia. Australian intelligence in 1963 would be London intelligence. I also find it fascinating that Priscilla Johnson was a CIA asset in working for JFK and in touch with Oswald and in touch with Marina after 1963. Echoes of Ruth Payne, The Appearance of Innocence. She only worked for JFK for a very short period of time, Priscilla Johnson. All right. She very quickly became an independent writer who was pretty successful, especially after she got the translation job for Svetlana Stalin. All right. I don't agree with this about Angleton. I think the evidence seems to indicate that Angleton was in on the plot to kill JFK. All right, Diana, I think her name is Guhula. Mr. DiEugenio, could you explain how there was anything to find in the present releases of the JFK? Well, I just did. I just went over about 10 things that I think are very interesting. I think number one is the Schlesinger memo. These documents were gone through before human error. I don't know about that. All right. It was not a perfect murder. All right. I think that what happened here was this. Trump went back on his word, if you recall, back in 2017. And he didn't release all the JFK documents. I believe he was reminded of this during the campaign by Andrew Napolitano and Joe Rogan. Okay. And they both reminded him that he had broken his promise. And I don't think Trump likes being shown up in public like that. All right. So I think that's the reason that he signed the order and he gave Tulsi Gabbard the lead role. And I think she overrode the objections from the FBI and the CIA. All right. I mean, did you see her on TV?
Yeah, but, you know, you could go further on that, that Trump had this the phony Russiagate, the so many things that were phony, you know, the 33 felony charges, you know. We don't have to go through that, but I think he was like saying, okay, you pissed me off, FBI, I'm hitting you back. I'm going to, you know, now you guys got to scramble to cover your asses as I release these things.
I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. It was his way of revenging himself. All right. Now, I think Tulsi Gabbard had special instructions from Trump, okay, to override the FBI and the CIA and to put out as many documents as she could with no redactions. Now, it's not true that every single document is clean, because I've seen about two or three of them that are slightly redacted. But in comparison to what we used to get before, these documents are very clean, all right? And no, I would not call the JFK assassination a perfect murder. I'd say it was a perfect cover-up. The Warren Commission gave them a very good cover-up. The problem was when you went through their evidence, like, say, for example, Mark Lane did, you understood that no human being could cover up a crime as bad and as evil as that one. All right. Also, do you have any idea why Jack Schlossberg has called the release as criminal? You know, I don't understand that guy, do you?
Well, for people who don't know, explain.
He's Caroline Kennedy's son. Okay. And he's got a big mouth, like he owns a JFK case. And he's against this total disclosure. I mean, you can go ahead and look him up online. You know, if he had a valuable thing to say about this, I wouldn't mind. But he doesn't. He's sort of like saying, you know, you're defiling my grandfather's legacy or something like that. I think that's the message he wants to pull out. I don't think we're doing that at all. I think we're honoring who JFK was by trying to get the truth about how he died.
Right.
All right.
And I'm kind of understating here, like saying, well, who is this? Like, you know, who is it? Like, you know, what have you done in the last 63 years?
Right.
You know, like nothing. And it's a negative number. So why should I care what you say? I mean, it's a little uninspiring, defeating when you hear the Kennedy family members kind of at arm's length who haven't done anything. I mean, John Barber's done more to try to have files opened up, you know, with the FBI and that. And the one thing about these files that they do not really expose, well, we looked into this to the nth degree, and here's how Lee did it. Here's how Lee did it. No, it's the opposite. And for anyone even at arm's length to listen to you and Oliver on TV and then go, well, I'm going to look into it a little further. I mean, it's just the tip of the iceberg.
I agree. I think that's going to be the first time that a lot of people were ever exposed to this kind of information. We'll see how it plays out. Matt Antwort, April the 4th. After listening to the testimony in front of Congress, I wondered if Oswald was a CIA agent working to stop the assassination. The point of view from the building is not a clear view of the road, but was a vantage point to view the people watching and beyond. From what I heard, I wondered if he was sent to watch for others known to pose a threat. So he was sent to provide protection rather than the action he is known for. That is probably generally true, although the specifics I don't think that he's talking about Oswald's vantage point, because I don't believe he was on the sixth floor. Okay. But I think overall that thesis is accurate, that Oswald was a counterintelligence spy. Okay. And there's evidence for that about the Chicago plot, because as we know, the informant on the Chicago plot was named Lee. So that's a very interesting coincidence, if it was a coincidence. I'm not so sure it was.
But also, if he is the patsy, like Thomas Arthur Vallee would have been the patsy there, you know, that all they got to do is move him around like a pawn, right? And
yes.
So, you know, my point of view is I don't know that he was supposed to break up anything. I think that maybe he was going to be flowing out of town, you know, with the whole Redbird Field stuff earlier, you know, and then if he landed in Cuba, they would have had you just killed our president. We're going to nuke the island, you know.
By the way, did you see at the end where I brought in the three plots?
Go over that just for people who didn't see it.
At the very end, I managed to bring in that there were three assassination attempts on JFK in November. And not very many people know about this, not very many people in the public. There was the one in Chicago, there was the one in Tampa, and the successful one in Dallas. And the one in Chicago so much resembled the successful one in Dallas that if all that information would have been forwarded, the plot in Dallas might have been thwarted. And that the one in Tampa was almost the opposite of Dallas in the sense that there were literally scores of FBI and Secret Service agents to protect Kennedy there. And he was so gratified that they had done it that he insisted on waiting behind at the Floridian Hotel to congratulate every agent that was in on his protection. I believe this is because he had to call off the Chicago visit, which I believe was the first weekend in November. All right. He called off that visit because I think of the warning he got. All right. Then he decided to go to Tampa. All right. And they, because of the warning they got there, they got all kinds of Secret Service agents, FBI agents, state troopers, etc. All right. In other words, Len, Kennedy was not getting out of 1963 alive. All right. April the 4th, 2025. Shimon Akondo. It popped up on YouTube, so I watched it. On the other hand, just like Baker's statement that he saw Oswald, I may have just made the whole thing up, but according to what Oliver said, he seemed to believe it. Shouldn't you guys be on the same page? I think what he's referring to there is that I don't believe the second floor soda pop machine event, okay? If anybody doesn't know what I'm talking about. The story is that Trulian Baker saw Oswald drinking a Coke out of the soda, or Dr. Pepper, excuse me, out of the soda machine right after the assassination. It was then after that they went up, and Dorothy Garner saw them come up after the two girls went downstairs.
Yeah, and you're talking about Roy Truly and Officer Marion Baker
Right.
So
that's... I think that, for example, who's that guy who wrote the book about Prayer Man? You had him on your show. He believes that the second floor encounter was not real. One reason is Bart Camp. One reason being that Baker did not mention it in his first day affidavit. And what makes that even more curious is that Oswald was sitting right across from him in the witness room when he was making out the affidavit. So if it had happened, why didn't he just walk over and say, wasn't that you who I stuck my gun in his stomach this morning? Well, nothing like that happened. And believe me, the Warren Commission understood what a problem this was, because Alan Dulles tried to give an excuse for not doing that. So me and Oliver might differ on that, but we don't differ on the thing about what was going on the fourth floor. The thing about Sandy Stiles, Dorothy Garner, and Victoria Adams. All right. They should have at least heard Oswald coming down the stairs. Okay. They should have at least heard him. Because, like I said before, those are not modern steps, which are usually shallow and cushioned. These were the old rickety style hammer and nails wooden stairs. Okay, Tim Sparks, April the 4th. Kind of looks like with all the personal attention the intel community gave Oswald all those years, that maybe the idea was to bring JFK to Dallas to put him in the kill zone. Bring the water to the horse, like with them using organized crime to solve their problems in Cuba. Maybe we've been looking at the wrong angle. Well, I think what he means is that they were setting up Oswald and then decided to move Kennedy
into that location, right? As a matter of fact, when she took the phone call, there was supposed to be a job offer for Lee to work at the airport.
And Ruth Payne, you're talking about.
Right, and I had often thought that, well, Kennedy lands, the airport is a big place to cover, and some sniper could have been somewhere, and Lee Oswald's there working, that could have provided the perfect situation as well.
Well, see, the problem I have with that is the previous plots. Arthur Vallee in Chicago and Gilberto Lopez in Tampa. So maybe this was a, you never know about these things. Was Chicago a dress rehearsal? Was that a run-through?
Well, something that's important, I don't think they have dress rehearsals. I think they tried to get the thing done and it failed.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then Gilberto Lopez, of course, had been at a Fair Play for Cuba committee meeting. And then after Tampa, he goes to Texas, he goes to Mexico City, and he's the only passenger on a flight from Mexico City to Havana. Now, even the House Select Committee said the fact that the Warren Commission bypassed Gilberto Lopez was an extraordinary shortcoming of their inquiry. So these are the things that really puzzle me. And we know that Vallee resembled Oswald's profile also, because he was a former Marine who trained Cuban exiles, okay? And he was at a base that had the U-2. So, can all these things be coincidences? I think you've run out of your allotment, if they were. Okay, Al Marsh, April the 11th. Hi, Jim. Since Trump appointed the CIA director, can't Trump force the director to turn over the George Ioannidis file, unredacted? I had heard that the director was into transparency. I see they're already looking at the RFK and MLK case. Don't you think it would be even better to do one thing at a time, as they haven't even completed the JFK case? What about the 2,400 files that were stored at the FBI? Have they all been released yet? Did the committee ever interview any of the folks at Parkland? I heard that Paul Landis was going to be at the hearing, as well as Thunheim and a whistleblower that Jeff knew about. Had heard some didn't want to be there. I wonder why. Great work you folks are doing. All right. I actually think he's right on this first point. I think Trump can order the Ioannidis file to be turned over, unredacted. I think that's true. All right. Now, it's true also that they're looking at the MLK and the RFK cases. I think they're done with the declassifications of the JFK case. But Tulsi Gabbard said 100 people working on the RFK and MLK cases, because those are all paper. There wasn't the interest in those cases that there was in the JFK case, and therefore she's had to scan those, all right? And she says she literally has dozens of employees doing that scanning, which I think is a really good thing to do. Yes, the 2,400 pages at the FBI were turned over. Now, I haven't had a chance to go through those yet. I think Jeff Morley is going through them. And did the committee, yeah, from what I understand, the Luna committee is going to go to Dallas. Okay. So they're going to interview who's ever left over there. All right. I heard that Paul Landis was going to be at the hearing, as well as Thunheim. And it was, well, I think she's going to call a second hearing. Okay. And I think if those people, and you know, you don't have to be in a hearing setting to take somebody's testimony. All right. You can do it an over the phone interview. You can do it in a formal deposition, or you can do it at a public hearing or a private hearing. So there's all those ways that they can talk to Landis and Thunheim and Jeff's whistleblower. So I don't think this is over. I think that Luna is going to keep on going at this thing until she's satisfied that the American public is fully informed about this case. All right. Okay. So that's it for the letters. Thank you so much for keeping them coming. I'll be glad to answer all your questions.
Okay, well, very good. It's
things are getting exciting, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah. And it's kind of, there's an irony here for people like Posner or Fred Litwin to be complaining, you know, like, oh,
isn't that great?
Yeah,
isn't that great? They're on the outside looking in, okay, instead of the inside looking out, and so now they're moaning and complaining, okay, about the fact that after 62 years. The critics actually got their day, you know. They want to dominate the whole thing because they know there's so many holes in their story that the public would never believe it if it was fully exposed.
And when you – I've been following the USAID exposés, and just the amount of money is mind-boggling, staggering, the things that they have been funding – especially in the areas of disinformation and, you know, just the stuff about COVID and the lab leak. And there are people now that think that was leaked on purpose, you know.
Wow. Okay.
You know, so anyway, different topic. But I was glad to see you on TV with Oliver. And it didn't look like anybody was showboating. It just looked like, hey, it's about time you guys have been doing this. And, yeah, I mean, good for Oliver for doing this because I don't know if, you know, how much time and effort and money it cost him to do all that and put together these things. And you would hope there's, you know, enough public interest that when he makes a documentary, it will do well financially, you know. So, of course, your continual work at Kennedy's and King. So, just thanks, and thanks again for making time tonight to let people know a little inside information about what went on and your point of view of it.
You're welcome, Lynn. Glad to do it.
All right. And before we wrap up then, is there anything else?
No, I went through all the letters.
Okay. All right, then. All right. Well, we'll talk to you in a week or two. And
all right.
Good. Thank you.
Good night.
Okay, good night.